Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in United States against Raddatz. Levander, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case is here on the government's petition to review a decision of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. At issue is the construction and constitutionality of the Federal Magistrates Act. Respondent, who's previously been convicted of numerous felonies, was indicted in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois on one count of unlawfully receiving a firearm. Prior to trial, respondent moved to suppress various statements that he had made to the Chicago police at the time of his arrest and also to federal agents on two subsequent occasions. Respondent claimed that these statements were inadmissible as a matter of both Fourth and Fifth Amendment law. In accordance with Section 636B1B of the Federal Magistrates Act, the district court designated a magistrate to conduct an evidentiary hearing regarding respondent's pretrial suppression motion. Following an extensive hearing, the magistrate made proposed findings of fact rejecting respondent's claim. In particular, the magistrate found that the testimony of the federal agents was more credible than that of respondent, and he recommended that the motion be denied. The district court thereafter, pursuant to Section 636B1C of the Federal Magistrates Act, made a, quote, de novo determination of respondent's motion. That is, the district court made a thorough review of the transcript of the hearing held before the magistrate, the magistrate's report, and the submissions of the parties, and he thereafter denied the motion to suppress evidence. Subsequently, respondent was convicted based on the evidence at the suppression hearing and some stipulated facts. On appeal, however, the Court of Appeals reversed. The Court first acknowledged that the proceedings in the District Court had complied with the Federal Magistrates Act. The Court further found that the Federal Magistrates Act did not violate Article 3 of the Constitution. Nonetheless, the Court concluded that the Due Process Clause of the Constitution requires the District Court either to defer to the magistrate's proposed findings of fact or to rehear the testimony itself. And since the statute prohibits the deference that the court felt the Due Process Clause requires, the Court of Appeals sent the case back to the district court for a second duplicative suppression hearing to be conducted personally by the district court.
Mr. Levander, what if after the denial of the suppression motion, but at the point at the trial of the case where the government sought to introduce the confession, the defendant had objected and said, under Jackson against Deno, an opinion of this court, I'm entitled to the judge's determination as to whether it's voluntary or not before it goes to the jury?
Well, it didn't exactly, it wasn't a formal trial, as I understand it. the trial was based on the stipulations and the transcript.
Well, that's how lots of trials are conducted nowadays, because the defendants don't have any defense if they lose their suppression motion.
Right.
But let's supposing we're talking about a defendant who really did have a defense and had an argument to make that not only his confession was involuntary, but had witnesses to put on an alibi and that sort of thing. Do you think that the district judge would have been required under those circumstances when the confession was offered at trial to conduct a hearing and listen in person to the suppression motions?
Let me understand, see if I understand your question, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. In that, in your hypothetical, the defendant moved prior to trial and got had a hearing before a magistrate?
Had exactly what he got in this case.
No. Again, that would be the same thing as this case. Once the magistrate has conducted the hearing and a district court has made its de novo determination of the motion, that's the end of the ballgame. Now, if it...
He's already gotten everything that Jackson has been...
That's right. He's had an impartial arbiter evaluate his testimony, and thereafter the district court makes its de novo determination of the motion. He's gotten more, in fact, than what Jackson against Deno... requires.
But I suppose what happens under the federal procedure now in a federal court, the evidence as to if it's a jury trial, the evidence as to voluntariness that goes to the jury too, doesn't it?
That's right. Under 18 U.S.C. 3501, I think it's A or B. I can't remember.
The only function of the hearing in the federal system is to make sure that the jury's entitled to hear the evidence at all.
That's right. And in Jackson against Deno, of course,
they could reject it.
That's right. And in Jackson against Deno, of course, the court held that the jury that determines guilt or innocence is not permitted to make that initial determination.
Initial determination.
Right.
But you say that that somehow a magistrate is more impartial and more neutral than a jury in making that sort of decision.
Well, I don't know how you would compare one to the other, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, but I would say that he is an impartial arbiter. He's not some person off the street. He's a federal employee who is, you know, there's no claim in this proceeding that the magistrate misconducted the hearing in any way.
Well, there's no claim in most proceedings that juries have misbehaved either. And yet Jackson against Deno says you can't submit a confession to them
I think you can. And the footnote in Jackson against Deno and also in Lego against Toomey, the court reiterated that you could give it to a jury. It just can't be the same jury that decides guilt or innocence. In other words, you could have a suppression hearing at which a jury was impaneled and listened to the evidence and made a determination of voluntariness. Thereafter, at trial, you would have to have another jury decide the question of guilt or innocence. The court made quite clear in both Jackson against Deno and in footnote 9, I believe it is, of Lego against Toomey, that it's just got to be a neutral fact finder, that is, the trial judge, another judge, or another jury. It just can't be the jury that tries guilt or innocence.
Which presumably is not a neutral fact finder.
Well, the theory, I think, in Jackson against Deno is that the jury will be misled as to the question of voluntariness because it will look to the reliability. And since the question of voluntariness does not involve the question of reliability, but rather involves solely the question of the policeman's behavior or the constable's conduct, the court said that due process requires that a neutral fact finder that's not concerned with guilt or innocence make the determination. In this court, respondent makes essentially three claims.
By the way, before you go on, is there anything final about the magistrate's recommendation?
It is not final. It is not determinative, and he has no power to make a determination. As the statute divides pretrial matters into two kinds of categories, as to most pretrial matters, which I would call procedural for want of a better nomenclature, or subsection A matters, the magistrate is authorized to, quote, hear and determine the matter. And as to that, the district court makes a review as if it were a court of appeals. That is, it can reverse for errors of law and for findings of fact which are clearly erroneous. However, as to the type, subsection B or case dispositive motions, as they're sometimes referred to, which include prisoner petitions, motion to suppress evidence in a criminal case, prisoner petitions regarding the conditions of confinement. As to those kinds of more important motions, Congress established a different standard of review. That is, the magistrate only makes a proposed finding of fact and recommendations of law, and it's the district court which actually must make the decision. And he does not have to give a clearly erroneous deference to the fact-finding.
But the judge has more than in those kinds of cases, the district judge has more than two choices.
That's correct.
He can hold a hearing himself.
He could. He's empowered to do that. He's also empowered to send it back to the magistrate for further hearings to recommit the matter.
Or he can accept it.
Accept, reject, or modify in whole or in part.
But he can hold a hearing himself if he thinks that if someone convinces him that he really ought to hear the witnesses himself.
That's correct.
He can hear them.
That's right. But the Court of Appeals in this case, and for good reason in our view, concluded there was no abuse of discretion in not holding such a hearing.
Well, we realize that in some cases, a motion to suppress is the determination of guilt or innocence.
Well, it may, as Mr. Justice Rehnquist pointed out a few moments ago, be determinative of the trial. But in Lego against Toomey, this court made quite clear that there is that the question at the suppression hearing, including a voluntariness hearing, has nothing whatsoever to do with guilt or innocence. And that has been repeated by this court on many occasions. And the question, we don't denigrate the importance of a suppression hearing in terms of effectuating constitutional rights.
Do you know how many narcotic cases go to trial after the denial of a motion to suppress?
Well, I suspect there are a fair number of guilty pleas if the defendant loses.
A fair number, around 80 or 90?
I don't know the statistic, Mr. Justice Marshall. Our position and a critical question on the statutory matter is what is a, quote, de novo determination. Our position is quite clear. A de novo determination is a thorough review of the evidence adduced before the magistrate, the magistrate's report, and the submissions of the parties. Respondent's position is not quite so clear. They say that de novo determination means what we say it means some of the time, but other times it means a de novo hearing. And they distinguish, and they say that it means a de novo hearing any time that the credibility of the witnesses is called into question. In other words, any time there's a conflict in testimony. But of course, in a suppression hearing, and certainly in habeas proceedings and all those kind of proceedings, virtually every pretrial hearing is going to involve a conflict in testimony. And so therefore, respondent's real position, I take it, is that in most cases, two hearings will be required.
Isn't conflicting testimony, in a sense, questions of credibility are almost always at issue, aren't they? To the extent that a judge or a magistrate has the right to ignore uncontradicted testimony.
That's true. Although respondent hasn't addressed that claim as to whether or not they would think, you might ask them whether or not second hearing would be required. At the outset, it is quite apparent in our view that the act, the respondent's construction of the act was utterly defeat Congress's purpose. Congress enacted the Magistrates Act to relieve the district courts of a tremendous burden in litigation. The statistics are fairly overwhelming. And in particular, Congress said in 1976 when it amended the act, we want magistrates to conduct these kind of evidentiary hearings. To require two hearings in every case would just obviously defeat what Congress sought to do, to relieve the district courts of pretrial matters so that they can conduct trials and decide to make decisions.
I suppose it wouldn't really be in every case, although maybe it would be most cases, because I suppose the parties could stipulate that they would accept the determination of the magistrate.
They could consent to it. That's right. I don't think the respondent contests that, but respondent here, of course, did not consent. The language and the legislative history of the Act squarely refute respondent's claim. The Act does not say the district court is required to make a de novo hearing of the evidence. It says must make a de novo determination of the magistrate's report. This distinction in language makes it clear, it seems to us, that there is not a de novo hearing requirement. It's simply, in contrast to subsection A motions, a different kind of review pattern. It's not the clearly erroneous pattern. It's a de novo determination pattern. Moreover, the Act itself empowers the district judge to conduct a second hearing. Now, if that grant of power would be wholly unnecessary if de novo determination meant de novo hearing, the power would already be there. So obviously, Congress thought it meant something else. Finally, where Congress thought it important in the body of the Act to require the district court to make a second hearing or to rehear the testimony, it expressly provided. 636D talks about contempt proceedings, and when the contempt occurs before the magistrate, Congress specifically stated that the district court must hear the testimony. Here, however, he only must make a de novo determination, something
quite... Isn't there a special reason for that? Because perhaps he would include among the witnesses on the contempt matter the testimony of the magistrate himself.
That might be...
Herself.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chief Justice. The legislative history, I think, answers any questions on this point. The original version of the 1976 amendment provided that the district court would have to rehear the testimony. Congress rejected this language. Instead of hear de novo, they put in de novo determination. And the legislative history makes clear that that language comes from a Ninth Circuit decision called Campbell against United States District Court, which is quoted at length and with approval in the House report accompanying the 1976 amendment. In Campbell, the Court of Appeals concluded that a district court could designate a magistrate to conduct a suppression hearing, and that thereafter the district court would make a de novo determination of the motion, which did not mean that it had to rehear the testimony. And the report itself, the House report itself, states that, and I roughly quote, use of the words de novo determination is not intended to require the district judge to conduct a new hearing on contested issues, squarely and flatly refuting respondents' construction of the act.
Well, what if this case had gone to trial not on the testimony of the suppression motion, but just after the motions that had been made, a regular trial on guilt or innocence, and a question was raised as to the admissibility of a point of evidence which required a determination by the judge as to whether the evidence was admissible. Do you think it would have been permissible for him to say, well, you present this testimony to a magistrate?
Well, that would not be a pretrial motion.
No.
And the Act speaks about pretrial motions. So therefore, I don't think there would be statutory power to do that. I mean, I think that...
Do you think it would be constitutional?
Yes, although it would be a very unusual circumstance for a district judge to do that, because it would certainly delay the process, and it would be hard for me to imagine the hypothetical where a district judge would really want to do that. Normally, questions of admissibility can be determined quite readily during the course of trial, and a district judge would have no reason to. But where he knows that he can set up his schedule and designate magistrates to conduct certain pretrial motions, then he would be inclined to do so.
Do you, you're not suggesting that in a jury trial, a judge could stop the trial and refer something to a magistrate after the trial has commenced?
No, under the statute, I would think he'd have no power to do that.
Statute doesn't permit him to do that.
That's right. I think Mr. Justice Rehnquist was asking me whether, hypothetically, if the statute provided that, would it be constitutional, and I didn't see any problem. The respondent defends the...
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock.